Hello, and welcome to Back Issue Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer.
In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about an older comic book storyline.
In this Back Issue Spotlight, I'm joined by Sam, and we're going to be discussing the first third or so of Shazam, the World's Mightiest Mortal, hardcover, the volume one. There's two volumes of this. Sam, how you doing tonight?
I am doing wonderful. How are you, John?
I am doing well. Now, this Shazam, World's Mightiest Mortal, hardcover, like I said, there's two volumes of it. It reprints some of the 1970s Shazam series. And I say some of the series because while it covers the entire 35-issue run of the series, it's only included the material that was created in the 70s. Now, the series itself included reprints of some of the Golden Age material. Now, what's kind of weird about this is at that point in time, I believe Shazam, or Captain Marvel as he was then known, was a licensed property for DC still owned by Fawcett. But they'd stopped publishing comics almost exactly 20 years earlier, because this was, I think, 73, and they stopped in 53, essentially as a result of the lawsuit that DC had filed against them, saying that Captain Marvel was too much like Superman. Now, this hardcover covers the first 18 of those 35 issues. It's around 350 pages, so we're breaking this hardcover into roughly thirds, and in this episode, we're going to be discussing about the first third or so, which is issues 1 through 8, of that 1970s Shazam series, with the caveat that number 8 was a 100-page giant of all Golden Age reprint material, so the only thing they included in this hardcover was the cover.
Yeah, yes. Nice one page. That was a quick read.
Yeah. And I was very curious about this going in, because I am familiar with the Captain Marvel of the 70s, but not through the comics, through watching the TV show.
Oh yeah, of course.
And that was the live-action Filmation stuff, and it's a cool character. So I picked these up a while back when they came out and stuff, and was very excited to do that, go through and read them and stuff. Going into this, really, when I was starting to look at that first story, and some of this I had expected, some of it not so much, at this point in time in the 70s, this was before full color, you know, Photoshop quality coloring and stuff. So we got fairly flat covers.
Covers are a whole different issue. We'll get to with number two.
Yeah, true. They had some photo covers, but the colors in the comic themselves?
Yes.
You know, there's not the 3D rendering and stuff like that, and that's fine. I grew up on comics of this era and such.
It's not, I'm trying to figure out how to put this. It is not the coloring that stands out, because again, we've been doing things not quite this old, but from the 70s. What stands out to me is the inking. It's in many ways, much of this is more simplistic with the inking. No Zippitones or textures or any of that's used. Very little. The inking is just done to define the characters and big objects in the. There's no shading really done with the inking.
Well, I think it's more than just the inking. I think overall it's a.
Almost more like a comic strip.
I was going to say comic strip. I was going to say more simplified style. But yeah, comic strip. The other thing I'd equate it to would be like the Uncle Scrooge and the Ducks comics.
Yes. It also reminds me, as a kid, I read a lot of this growing up, the Harvey comics from the same era.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, that's got more of a comic strip style of art than kind of a traditional comic book style of art. And it's a subtle difference.
Yes.
But a clear one at many times.
Yeah. The art, I think, still really good, but it is different than I think what we're used to in comic books.
Yeah, and I think that because they had C.C. Beck, the original artist and such, on this series at this point, he was on for the first 10 issues or so. While these are Silver Age stories, technically, they're kind of reminiscent of Golden Age stories, certainly visually and to an aspect story-wise, too.
They are in a lot of ways. And, yeah, it's interesting. There's, in what we read, I believe it's all C.C. Beck.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly Denny O'Neill writing, some Bridwell, or one Bridwell, and a few of the second stories by Elliot Magan. But, yeah, it's... Like I said, at least to my eye, of the stuff I'm familiar with, it reminds me most of the Harvey stuff from the same era.
Yeah, well, and this was a widely anticipated comic before it launched. Because, you know, wow, the Captain Marvel character is coming back for the first time in decades. And I recall, after the fact, not having been, in comic shops when it first came out in the early 70s, that, people had stockpiles of them because they'd gotten tons of them thinking, wow, a first issue, it's going to be worth a ton. And, speculator boom and bust kind of a story on that.
Well, I would assume, particularly this first story where it talks about the 20 missing years and then kind of does a flashback. Had it been 20 years that the character had been out of print?
Yeah.
That kind of semi-realistic?
Almost exactly 20 years, yeah.
Okay.
Cause,
and so I'm assuming where that's a lot where that came from.
Yeah, yeah. Because at this point, it's not that they were doing real-time passage in comics, but kind of, sort of, had the conceit that they sort of were, even though the characters didn't age. Weird, but... I mean, this first issue basically had to reset up the character for new readers, explain where he'd been for, old fans and such, and we get two stories. The first one, which is only about six pages, is basically acknowledging he's been gone for 20 years and hasn't aged, and then a kind of a recap of his origin.
Okay. Yeah. I tend to agree with that, what it is. It is what it is.
The second story, which was about 10 pages long, really went towards explaining that 20-year gap.
Yes. And, that's, at least for this series, it's, where you get Junior and Mary for the first time in this book, and...
Mm-hmm. Well, in the Savannah family.
Yes.
And basically it comes down to a plot by Savannah to trap the Marvel family in suspended animation forever, but things go a little wrong, and they get kind of stuck in there, too.
Yep.
And eventually, 20 years later, Captain Marvel's able to kind of break them out and get them back home. It's one of those things that it gives you enough in terms of the origin and explaining the gap. Whether it would have been enough to hook a new reader, a kid that had never read the older stuff, I don't know.
Yeah, I can see either way.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I said, I enjoyed it. It's simple, it's fun, and while Tawny is not in this issue technically, he is seen in it on the last panel at least. Sorry, not the last panel, page before.
Oh, when we get the...
Page
the,
23 in the book.
Yeah, the friends or whatever and stuff.
Yes.
Out of that whole group, there were only two characters I recognized. Takitani was one of them, and Uncle Dudley was the other.
Yes.
But I am not really that knowledgeable on kind of the Golden Age Captain Marvel stuff. So, a lot of these are people he worked with and stuff like that.
Yep.
I did appreciate the fact that they included the text page from the comic, which gave the list of who some of these characters were.
Yes, absolutely. It does. It explains them all.
So it was a good issue. It definitely set the scene and such. And the tone and the style, like I said, was a little more Golden Age than I was expecting for something done in the Silver Age.
I tend to agree. It was. If you had told me this book came out in 1973... This is not what I would have exactly assumed it would be like.
But if I told you it was from 53, it'd probably fit in right there, right?
Yeah, it would seem fine. And then, like you said, we'll get to issue 2, and this is where you see that these photo covers that I am just not a fan of. I'm sure these were kind of cool and cutting edge at the time.
Yeah, I wasn't too crazy about that, because they're doing it with a technology that I don't think was quite up to it.
Yes. Well, it's kind of like that. If you ever go back to the original Disney shorts when he was still in Kansas City, and you get those Alice Through the Looking Glass, those Alice cartoons where it's the people mixing with the animated characters, it almost has a similar look to that, which, again, doesn't look quite right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and at this point, the cover still had the subtitle or tag or whatever of the original Captain Marvel.
Yes.
I don't know that they were able to continue with that through the run. I think they might have gotten a cease and desist from Marvel.
At some point, that's entirely possible. I'm trying to think. I'm going to flip ahead here.
Because I'm thinking a ways into it, they flip it to the world's mightiest mortal.
Yes, which does appear to be the case in the last few anyways.
Yeah, because again, while he'd been out of print over at Fawcett, which kind of shut down their comic stuff in the 50s, Marvel had decided, well, why don't we have a character called Captain Marvel? So they created one.
Yes.
And then another one, and then another one, but that's another story. So, again, at this point, I'm pretty sure that this character was licensed to DC. They eventually bought it outright. But that's why, you know, he goes by Shazam these days versus Captain Marvel. All the trademark and copy trademark issues, mainly. But yeah, in the second issue, we get Mr. Mind and such. And at this point, I'm assuming he'd still been on Earth or whatever and wasn't part of the suspended animation type stuff. But what really got me was not only is Billy having to figure out what the 70s are like in short order, but a lot of his friends and stuff have gotten their jobs back. You know, Talkie Tawny is a guide at a museum, which, you know, he's a talking tiger. That in and of itself is odd enough. A museum guide or whatever, that's kind of wild. But this museum is covering what I would consider current event type stuff of, you know, Mr. Mind, the Monster Society, and stuff like that.
Well.
So I'm not quite sure what sort of museum this exactly was.
It's very convenient that it gives you a chance for exposition.
True. Well, and I guess since it'd been 20 years, maybe it's not current events. This is stuff that's, you know, almost a generation old for these people.
Yes.
So, but it's one of those things where, you know, since these are shorter stories, I think this one was only about 10 pages or so. It doesn't take long for the action to kick in, Billy to shout the magic word in plain sight of pretty much everybody, and, you know, try to save the day. And we really don't get a whole lot of Mr. Mind in this. He was only there to, I think, steal his glasses and his voice box thing.
Well, it's just simply impossible to find frames in his size, of course.
Well, yeah, and I imagine the lenses aren't any easier. Of course, I want to know with this voice amplifier thing that looks like a radio he's got as a necklace or whatever. It's got two knobs on it. What good do they do him? He doesn't have any arms.
Fair enough.
How does he get his glasses on and off? It's the mind boggles. But the way this story kind of sort of ends is, you know, Mr. Mind has gone underground in St. Louis. Captain Marvel basically uses the St. Louis arch as like a tuning fork or something to get the worms to come up, you know, and spots the spectacles on Mr. Mind or whatnot. And there's and I really don't know what the right term for this is. I don't want to say silly or ridiculous, but that's the sort of stories we get here.
Yeah, they're fun, they're cute, they're comic booky.
Yeah, they're light reading, and not in a bad way.
Exactly.
And it's a world in which anything can happen. And I think the second story here really kind of shows that, where we get introduced to Sunny Sparkle, who's a guy that people just like and want to give stuff to and want to help.
Yep.
Like, to like a crazy degree. It's like he's got almost an innate superpower of sorts. And again, you know, wackiness ensues and whatnot. And, you know, people rob a bank and bump into him and decide, oh, we ought to give the money to you. And then realize maybe they shouldn't have. It's one where, again, this feels, like I said, more Golden Age than Silver Age. But it works. It's just not the kind of story you would expect to see, certainly at all, in a modern-day comic.
No, and it's interesting you compared it to some of the Duck stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree. It actually reminds me a lot of, like, the Carl Barks Dell Duck stuff, which is, you know, what, mostly the 40s?
Yeah, again, Golden Age type stuff.
Yeah.
But this story introduces, kind of quietly, but the idea that this kid has something about him which makes him different. I'm going to call it a superpower. You can call it whatever you want.
Yep.
You know? And in later stories, we, well, obviously we know magic exists. That's how Captain Marvel exists. But we also get a lot of signs of super science. Well, again, the whole suspendium stuff and Savannah and all that. I mean, super science, magic, and the mystical or whatever totally exists in this world. Yet nobody seems to really be too surprised or put out by it.
Fair enough.
I just, as I was reading through this, in the back of my mind, I was just kind of wondering, would I want to live in this world or not?
Why not?
Well, we get to a couple of stories, like in the third issue, the second story there,
mm-hmm.
where we've got a scientist who creates a device, turns it on for a fraction of a second, and the hill he's living on starts to fly out into space.
Yes.
You know, because he invented a crazy powerful anti-gravity machine. And he wasn't trying to do anything evil or something, but it just seemed like, again, anything is possible. So you could be walking down a street minding your own business, and, you know, who knows what's going to happen next.
You know what's interesting? I happen to have just watched it myself in the last month or so. Do you remember the Warren Beatty Dick Tracy movie?
Yeah, I remember it. It's been a while since I've watched it.
But if you ever watched that film, the filmmakers went out of their way to make that world more comic booky than kind of normal world would be. And it reminds me a lot of this world, kind of in a similar way.
Well, yeah, because that movie embraced the limited color palette,
yep.
the look of the various characters,
yep.
and I don't want to say the shtick or whatever, but the sensibility of that world they adapted into the movie.
Yes, and a lot of this book feels like it would be right at home in that same world.
Now, the Speed Racer film that the Wachowskis did about
very
a decade
different.
Or so back, very different, but similar translation of the anime style into a live-action movie.
Yes. Yeah, that's true.
So it's a question of, is that what the audience wants or not? And I think that's one of the challenges this series was facing of, should we be telling 70s-era style stories or Captain Marvel stories, which are rooted in the Golden Age and kind of crystallized at that point because they hadn't been told in 20 years? And I don't think either was the right or wrong answer, but I do think that had to be something they struggled with. Because, like, this first story in issue 3, I thought was great. And basically, you know, Billy is feeling that it's been 20 years. He was in suspended animation, but he feels older.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's out of touch with these kids, and almost like he's mentally aged the 20 years. So he goes to the wizard and basically says, you know, hey, I want to look as old as I feel. Now, he was in suspended animation, so I don't think he really aged in any way, shape, or form, but it's been 20 years, so he feels out of date, whatever. And the wizard ages Billy, which has the corresponding effect of essentially de-aging Captain Marvel when he shouts Shazam. So you've got an adult Billy and a teenage Captain Marvel, which I thought was a fun story.
Kind of fun. Yeah, kind of cute. And it not only ages him, it changes not only his age, but a lot of his look. Well, I realize on the first page he's wearing this outfit. He's wearing this green jacket.
Very atypical for Billy.
Very atypical for Billy, and arguably what someone would think is stereotypical of the early 70s.
Yeah.
Exactly. Atypical for Billy, but very stereotypical of the time for younger people.
This might be one of the few times we don't see Billy in kind of that traditional red shirt and blue jeans type look.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so for the green blazer and orange pants or whatever, kind of weird.
Yeah, you always see the red sweater and he's wearing a tie underneath it and, you know, something children of the 70s probably wouldn't wear.
Yeah, yeah. Even giving him his boy reporter or whatever type aspects, yeah, it still felt odd. But I liked how they aged Billy and made him look older and not just like he was Captain Marvel in civilian clothes.
No, not at all. It's a totally different in-between age Billy.
Yeah. Well, it's got the hairstyle and stuff like that, and Captain Marvel just looks smaller. I did like that we got kind of a cameo by Freddie Freeman.
Yes.
He doesn't really do much in the story, but he was at least there. But again, that second feature where we've got this scientist who's, you know, made this crazy invention that, you know, you turn it on and it's this crazy powerful anti-gravity machine and again, is about to throw this hill into space or whatever, you know. I couldn't figure out quite what the scientist thought he was doing and why he was announcing the machine if it was that dangerous to even turn on.
Is it just me, or the title, The Wizard of Phonograph Hill, the look of the architecture of this house and the look? This is a caricature of Thomas Edison.
Mm.
It was such a, you know, he was a showman as much as he was an inventor.
Fair enough.
I think that's where that comes from. I'm Dr. Thomas Kilowatt. You know.
I caught the kilowatt. I hadn't made the connection to Edison, though.
But it looks like his home in, you know, in New Jersey. Everything about it just screamed that they were kind of spoofing Thomas Edison.
Well, Phonograph Hill and stuff like that, yeah. So, I can see that now. But that's one of those things where, again, the super science knows no bounds in this world.
No.
Which, again, kind of reminds me of the Gyro Gearloose character over in the Duck stuff.
Yes.
You need a device, just ask him, give him a few minutes, and he'll whip one up. Now, in the next issue, we get Ibak the Cursed, which is one of the classic Captain Marvel villains. And just like Billy has his magic word, so does Ibak. But in his alter ego, he's pretty much a mild-mannered, I guess, janitor or something. But the powers that be behind him kind of coax him into action, even though I don't think he really wants to do evil as Mr. Print Whistle. And this was a story that also I found interesting because it starts setting what are at least the then current rules for how Captain Marvel's powers work. Playing a recording of Billy saying Shazam is enough to trigger the change.
Yes.
Which, okay, I don't have any problem with that, but it does seem like an interesting rule to lay down and one that could definitely have consequences. Not that this is a world of consequences, because, again, these short stories are, you know, 7 to 10 pages, and it's not like they reset between them, but there's not a ton of carryover.
No, there's not.
But that's, again, what they were going for, and it works. I do think, though, it's the kind of thing that some people would love these stories, other people would just hate them, because they're wanting the more modern long-form story and intricacies and stuff like that.
Like I said, I do think fans of the Disney Dell comics, I think, would enjoy these.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And like I said, even the 60s and early 70s Harvey stuff, too.
Yeah. Well, and again, I enjoyed them quite a bit. It's just you've got to be willing to go with lighter, shorter, wackier stories.
Yes.
Now, there was a couple of things about this story of the mirrors that predicted the future.
Mm-hmm.
That I was expecting it to go one way, and it didn't.
It didn't. I tend to agree with that.
Because when the guy is introduced as Conway Man, just call me Con, I'm like, this dude's a con artist. Says it right, yeah, in his name.
Well, and the mustache, the whole thing.
Yeah, he just reeked of that. But he apparently has the ability to see the future when looking through mirrors while either near or touching Billy Batson, which is a bizarre kind of, again, superpower or magic or whatever you want to call it. But they make the story work.
Yep.
You know, I don't know if this character ever shows up again, but I was expecting it to be more of a con artist story or have some kind of a twist like that, and it didn't. I also felt that Billy was a little more clueless in this issue. You know, the guy's like, something's big at stake. Oh, you're going to buy me a steak.
Yes.
I don't know, it just... Billy felt a little off in this story. Who was the writer of this one? This was Elliot Magn.
Yes.
Most of the rest we'd been getting were done by Denny O'Neill. So that maybe it was just that.
Yeah. It seems that Denny does most of the first ones and Magn does most of the second ones.
Well, and most of these issues had a third one, which was a reprint from the Golden Age stuff.
Golden Age, which are not in this particular collection.
Yeah, yeah. The next story in issue number 5 with the leprechaun.
Yes, that's a fun one.
It was a great one. It actually reminded me of kind of the feel of a Mr. Mixoplex and Superman kind of a story where you've got a character with magic. He's not always trying to do bad, but things happen and you've got to kind of trick him to undo it, which isn't,
yes,
exactly how this plays out, but it was close enough.
And again, much more like the Golden Age version of Mixoplex as opposed to the much more mischievous silver and particularly Bronze Age versions.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and this time a hobo, literally a hobo, comes across the leprechaun, captures him, gets the wish, becomes invisible, and of course starts robbing banks and whatnot. So basically, Cat the Marvel has to, once he realizes the leprechaun is how this happened, get the guy to capture the leprechaun and wish to be visible again, because that's the only way to undo the magic. And it's like, okay, there are rules in this world, that's cool. But the way Captain Marvel convinces the guy to wish to be visible again?
Dropping him?
Yeah.
It worked.
It did.
No one got hurt.
It did, but I'm curious how the leprechaun knew where to be. And it was good the leprechaun was game to help out on that. So, and it goes towards, again, you know, magical creatures like leprechauns in this world exist. Just bump into one on the street. So, again, not saying I would not want to live in this world, but it would be a very bizarre world to live in.
Certainly.
And the backup feature here with the world's toughest guy, which is a cousin of Sonny Sparkles.
Yes, good old Rowdy.
Yeah, this has a How to Do Everything book, which is almost the modern-day equivalent of a spell book or something?
Sure, why not?
Well, I mean, the pages are blank, but you go to the page, suddenly it turns visible and you can read it and you can do things. You know, stop the rain or whatever. Not a bad idea. Decent way to do a modern spell book, I guess. It was just bizarre concept, and in a good way.
Yeah, absolutely. One of my other favorite things about this particular one, let me see, this is September 1973, right?
Thereabouts, yeah.
So, is it just me, or is the gentleman they go to that blows Billy off and then helps Sonny out?
Oh, Archie Bunker.
And Edith, which would have been the number one show in the country in that part of 1973.
I hadn't even thought about that, but you're right. Yeah, I see it.
Yeah, that's Archie and Edith, no doubt about it.
That's funny. And it would take somebody like Sonny to get Archie to be nice.
Yes.
So, interesting with the kind of the topical references there that, you know, here I am, you know, many, 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 many years later, missing entirely until you point them out to me.
Well, and it's weird because while the gentleman's never named, at the very end, he even mentioned, calls his wife Edith.
Yeah, I just hadn't caught that part at all. I mean, I'd seen where he said Edith, but, and again, in the few panels she's in, acts like Edith from that show, yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
I just was so perplexed by this magic book just lying around, you know. It makes me wonder the backstory of this world. How do those things, sorts of things come to be?
The book's got all the... I'm trying to think how to put this.
It doesn't need a backstory, but I'm curious about one nonetheless.
It's got all the... One of the things I love about it is it's so stereotypical of ideas and notions from the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
But they're all hilarious, you know. Freckles and buck teeth is the good one. Freckles and a scowl is the bad one. You know, there's so many things that are just, I don't know, just hilarious and things that we kind of all instantly identify with now, but at this point, this was probably one of the first times those things were kind of being pointed out.
Yeah. Well, and there's an aspect of, not that it's a simpler world, because I certainly don't think that it is, but it's a little bit of a fish out of water story, ostensibly for Billy, although that kind of doesn't play in too much, but more for the readers, I think.
Yeah.
Because we're kind of seeing stories that are equally parts of the Golden Age and the Silver Age in a very interesting way. They're well, neither fully of either.
No, absolutely. Yeah, no, Billy and some of the stories, yes, they feel like Golden Age characters kind of living in the 70s.
Well, and if you had told me that Sonny and his cousin were from the Golden Age, I'd believe it. If you told me they were original to the 70s era, which I think they were, I'd believe that too.
Yeah, I have no idea.
You know, it kind of fits both ways. The little kind of, you know, morality lesson or whatever there on the final panel, it was all right. You know, where it's like, hey, you don't need to be a jerk kind of a thing. But
it is what it is.
Yeah. And again, sort of part and parcel of almost the 50s era, because that was the sort of thing that they'd often end the Superman show with. So now in issue 6, we get Dr. Savannah kind of back. And again, one of the aspects of this world is, you know, a wig and a fake beard, and you can fool anybody.
Oh, yes, of course.
Now, in fairness, if he hadn't taken the stuff off on the same page, I might not have caught on so quick either.
It's very true.
But the basic gist of this story is Savannah has gifted Billy with a watch that has a little bit of suspendium in it, which is what he'd used to trap them for 20 years. And it's somehow set up that the watch is going to pause Billy when he's in the middle of saying Shazam and just pause him for 2 minutes, which presumably is as much as he could get it to do or whatever. I'm still trying to figure out how he got it to trigger at the right point. But it was an interesting concept. Again, not the sort of thing I typically encounter in my superhero reading.
Universal willpower paralyzed. It's a genius idea.
What I found a little, almost, frankly, disappointing was the way Billy gets out of this jam.
Yes.
Is he walks by a place, thinks his watch is running slow, so he adjusts his watch. And of course, the minute he walks by, the owner of that shop goes out, realizes his clock's running fast, so he resets it.
Yes.
But having reset the watch, that's what causes it to go kind of haywire when Billy, you know, shouts Shazam again. Now, for all of this to work, Savannah had to know Billy was Captain Marvel. Okay, they've hung around enough, sure, why not? And what the magic word is. Which, given that Billy's shouting it in front of everybody, I'll grant. I really don't think Billy understood the concept of a secret identity.
No, he didn't need to.
Really?
It was a more innocent time.
He's constantly getting kidnapped.
Yes, but he can take care of himself.
True, true.
It leads him to the bad guys.
Well, and he sometimes has a recorder of him shouting Shazam, so he's okay.
Exactly. He can trigger with his nose.
So, all in all, it was an interesting story and, you know, wraps up within 8 pages. So, the pacing of these things, to have a beginning, a middle, a twist, and an end, or, you know, whatever you have in these things, in between 7 to 10 pages, compared to, you know, how slow some stories play out these days, it's definitely a different storytelling style.
Oh, yeah. And then the next story in this issue is as golden age and goofy as anything could possibly be.
Yeah, this was one of the ones that really hammered home for me that this is a world of super science. Because Dexter's got his own little private laboratory in a shed in the backyard. His grandmother, while dusting one of his devices, gets supercharged with enough electricity to power a city. Yet she's okay. She's just kind of hyperactive.
Well, you run away, a vacuum and then a steam iron?
Yeah, she's powering the appliances even though they're unplugged because she's got enough juice.
Yes.
Fortunately, Billy's there and can turn into Captain Marvel to save the day.
Right.
And then conveniently, there's a power outage in Miami that she's able to go, you know, save the day on, but they've got to take her by train because she's not going to fly. You know, and the whole she's a grandmother, she gets her way aspect was kind of funny. You know, this is another one that really had kind of that duck sort of story feel to it.
It really did.
You know, replace Dexter with Gyro, and probably would have been Donald who was supercharged or something like that, but, you know, whatever. It was a fun story, and, you know, it's typical of the sorts of stories we're getting here. There's no, you know, fate of the world for the most part at stake, but you can't just ignore the situation either. Now, I think Dexter was a recurring character, but again, I'm not familiar enough with these stories and stuff from either this era or the Golden Age to really know.
And then comes probably my favorite story in the entire set we're doing. Just because I've always had a soft spot for Tawny, and we get a Tawny story.
He's a great character, and he's so unique.
Totally unique.
They did, in Astro City, a riff on this kind of character a few times. And they were a lot of fun. And it was clear what they were riffing off of, because again, there's so... I'd be hard-pressed to name another supporting cast character as unique as Tawny.
There's none. And none as persistent.
Mm-hmm.
There's some one-offs, and, you know, the ones we can kind of all name, but think of actual issues with those characters, there's one or two.
Well, yeah, there are characters that have shown up, but they're not recurring members of the supporting cast.
Exactly.
Whereas with Captain Marvel, once you get past, you know, Freddie and Mary, who are, you know, sidekicks of a sort, you've got Tawny, you've got Uncle Dudley, and it really starts to run low after that.
Well, you've got the Wizard himself.
Yes, yes. True, true.
And then, of course, Savannah and Adam. Well, isn't in this at all.
Now you're getting to the Rogues Gallery.
Yes.
Of which he's got a fairly, you know, large one, once you include, like, all the Monster Society. But even just Black Adam, Ibak, the Savannah family, which is pretty numerous in and of themselves. Then there's Captain Nazi, there's Sabak, and, you know, he's got a fairly large one.
And Mr. Mind and shows Mr. up Mind. Semi-regularly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I did find it both hilarious and disturbing that one of the first things we get in this story is Tawny's just walking on the street and she's like, oh, that woman's wearing Uncle George.
Yes.
It makes me feel rotten. And I'm like, okay, it's a fur coat. How does he recognize it's Uncle George? I really don't want to know.
Well, the cover of this issue is great, too.
Yeah, yeah. What I found fun about this story is he's at I guess he's at the pier and sees some other tigers that have been shipped or whatever. And, of course, he's able to speak Tigerian, so he's able to talk with them. But before he's able to tell anyone about it, really, he goes undercover. Great disguise. He just takes off his clothes, which on one level makes perfect sense. On another level, a little kind of weird and creepy, depending how you look at it. But then quickly gets injured to where he can't talk for a little while. You know, one of the few things that makes him truly unique, other than the outfit and the intelligence, and now he can't use it. But it'd be an even shorter story if he could have just told Billy what was up in short order.
I do love the check made out to Animal Imposters, Inc. No, Importers, sorry.
Yeah.
Which, no, everything about it, the whole thing's great.
Mm-hmm.
And also, somehow in the middle of a city in the 70s, you still have a stereotypical, you know, the khakis, the shorts, the pith helmet, hunter out for safari.
Exactly, yeah. Because he's got to dress the part.
Of course.
What gets me is he uses the catnip and basically drives Tawny crazy enough that he's about to lop Billy's head off and bite through it. I mean, fortunately, he gets the gag first. Like I said, Billy's always getting kidnapped. Otherwise, it would have been a much shorter and gruesomer story.
Yes.
And I also like how instead of going back for his clothes he ditched, Captain Marvel takes him out to get a new suit.
Oh, yes, Mr. Julius's. Mod togs for the man and beast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some of these things are just, they're goofy, they're silly, they're fun.
I hadn't caught the man and beast part of the,
this is Mr. Julius' sign?
Yeah, the sign on the door. How many beasts are walking around these towns?
That's a good question.
That's the part of this world that I just don't know how comfortable I would or would not be. I mean, Tawny seems like a perfectly cool guy.
Yes.
But it would be, I think, a little off-putting to be, you know, talking with a tiger. Probably have a great conversation, though. So I thought that one was pretty good. The backup feature here, or the second feature here of what's in a name.
Yep.
This was basically almost a game of telephone where some thieves who live near Billy, one of them's telling, hey, don't use the phrase Captain Marvel, he'll hear us, you know, kind of a thing. That gets overheard. It's dangerous to say that. Can't do that. Somebody then hears about that, sees Freddy turning into Captain Marvel Jr. by shouting Captain Marvel, sees the lightning bolt, and poof, there's no Freddy anymore. Wow, the story's really true. You know, and the rumor spreads like wildfire and keeps getting exaggerated in the process to the point that Billy's being told you can't use the name on air. You know, so he's got to figure out what's going on there. And it seems like really the one it would be the most inconvenient for would be Freddy, not Billy, but still. Even Savannah kind of gets spooked by the whole thing.
Well, yes, that whole sequence where he goes to Savannah is great. Savannah, like, I was just sitting in my jail cell. I didn't do anything.
Mm-hmm. But we say your name, it could destroy the whole galaxy or whatever, and I want to rule the world, not destroy it. You know? So it was a crazy story, but they played kind of fair and built it.
Yes. Well, as much as you can build in 6 pages.
7 in this, but yeah. That extra page doesn't make a ton of difference, really. But when Billy overhears somebody trying to fence an expensive cane that's tipped in Captain Marvelous silverwork, oh, somebody said Captain Marvel, it must be safe, you know? So a little goofy, cheesy, whatever word you want to use, but still fun. And these are, you know, 6, 7, 8-page, 10-page stories tops. You're in, you're out, and you've gotten a story or two.
Yeah.
You know, and again, in these issues that at this point were 20 cents a shot, you'd get these two stories plus a third reprint, be another 5, 6, 7 pages or what have you. I think you were definitely getting your money's worth. But then that eighth issue was one of the 100-page super spectaculars, and that reprinted, I think, 8 different stories from the Golden Age.
Well, and it's interesting, by having just looked through it, by the end of this book, it looks like this had gone to a quarterly 100-page book. And they were 60 cents by that point. And that's just, again, looking ahead, look to, you know, 17, 18, 16, 15, those issues.
Even as early as 14 and 15 and stuff, I think, yeah, yes. It had gone quarterly. And it's interesting because, again, this hardcover tops out at issue 18. We've got the second, which goes for the other issues through 35. But then after that, I believe this went over into World's Finest, which was a 100-page book at the time. And then I think Adventure. And I think I've got those actual comics. I picked those up at one point. And I'm curious at what point in this run this kind of goes from these Golden Age style stories into a more Silver Age sensibility, if at all. Because most of the Captain Marvel I was reading in the comics at this point was stuff like over in DC Comics Presents, where it was not this kind of Golden Age goofiness, if you will, but he was on par with Superman and a similar story sensibility.
Yeah.
That's the kind of stuff I really love. So I'm expecting this to kind of gravitate towards that over the course of the run. But I think getting CC Beck to do the art initially was a great move. It really, I think, bridged the gap from the Golden Age to the Silver Age, perhaps a little too much. And it's a, like I said, it's an odd world with magic and super science, and people just really aren't taken aback by any of it. You know, you bump into a kid you haven't seen in 20 years and he's still a kid, and oh, well, that's odd, but okay.
Yeah, it looks like CC Beck last through issue 10.
Yeah. Issue 10. And I think he quit over creative differences.
Yeah. And then you get the shot around, you get a little bit of Offner, and then Schaffenberger kind of really takes over after that.
I'll be honest, I was wanting a little bit more of a Silver Age sort of style to the story, but I liked what we got, and it felt like light reading. If this were in my current mix of comics, it would certainly be very different than most of the comics I'm getting, much like Uncle Scrooge is. But knowing that going into the thing, I'd be fine with it. And sometimes it's nice just to have something that's not, you know, part of a 6-issue or 20-issue story arc or something. You know, in for a couple of pages, out, and let's move on to the next.
Absolutely. I wasn't exactly what I was expecting. Having read the Jerry Ordway...
Power of Shazam series, yeah.
Yeah, which is what, more early 90s, I want to say?
Yeah, yeah.
That I was expecting more along that place. I love this. This is going right on my bookshelf, like I said, like my classic Carl Barks Disney library. It's great stuff, and as we talked about kind of before we started reading this, I said, oh, maybe I'll have my kids look at it. Once I got into it, I was actually surprised. My boy didn't seem very interested. Hmm. My daughter, on the other hand, absolutely loved it and thought it was hilarious.
That's cool. It definitely has an all-ages aspect to it.
Oh, absolutely.
Was there anything in particular that kind of bored your son?
This is weird because what he does read, he did not care for the art. That being said, what he does read does not have better art. It has similar art, but it's just slightly different. My son reads, you know, the Big Nate series, Diary of Your Wimpy Kid, Dogman.
Is that a more cartoony style?
How do I want to put this? I think it's easier for him to ape.
Got it.
If that makes any sense. Those books he looks at and he can try drawing them, and they come kind of close. This, while it's not what we think of as like a really great artist in modern comics, It's not something simple an 8-year-old can just look at and do either.
I can see that that would give the other stuff an accessibility art-wise to him that this almost would seem out of reach.
Yeah, exactly.
I can understand that. I hadn't thought about that, but interesting. And again, these are fun stories that don't take themselves too seriously.
Yep.
And are easy reads in a good way.
Yeah, exactly. And then my daughter, who doesn't have much of an interest in art and doesn't try to copy the stuff she reads, mainly loves like the DC superhero girls and stuff, the bright colors, it's kind of humorous, and I think that's why she enjoyed this more.
Yeah.
Because I think it's similar in that way, even though they aren't all teenage girls, it's the bright colors, there's jokes, it's, you know.
Absolutely bright colors.
Yep.
And this is one of the things I love about it is it just pops off the page.
Yep.
And for me, there's a sweet spot. And again, some of the stuff I think I was reading from the DC Comics Presents was probably almost a decade after these stories.
Okay.
So I'm hoping that there's a period in time at the end of this run going into that World's Finest and Adventure Comics stuff where we've still got this basic Captain Marvel, but it's a little bit more of a Silver Age sensibility, more on par as a peer of Superman versus comedic.
Well, here's what I can tell you just flipping through this hardcover. The art and the amount of words per page look more Silver Age-y as we get farther into this book than they do at the part where we were, you know, in the part we're covering tonight.
That's kind of what I was expecting.
Also, for those listening, if you're interested and want to check it out and don't want to either hunt down the book or buy it or anything, if your local library system has Hoopla, I was checking. This is available on the Hoopla app, so if you just want to kind of check it out for free, that's a possibility as well.
Well, and we're going to do 2 more episodes on this volume.
Yep.
And then I'm game for doing the second volume covering the other 17 issues or whatever. Yeah.
Sure.
And if people have questions, comments, or whatever, please let us know. We'll include those comments in the next episode that we do on these. Because I like this version of the Captain Marvel family, frankly, a lot more than the current one.
I like this version. And again, flipping through this and having read a few more issues than what we covered tonight, it looks like Mary and Freddie really start appearing in these as we go on here. And those two characters, it's weird. Billy's always seemed a little boring to me.
Mm-hmm.
I think Freddie, Mary, and Tawny are all characters I enjoy more than Billy.
Yeah, I think if they had done a series with Mary and Freddie, I'd have been on board with that if they'd done that in the 80s.
Yep.
And I like some of what they'd done with Mary, both in The Power of Shazam and some of the stuff after that. And I liked what they had done with the Shazam family and stuff in the 80s when Roy Thomas kind of had some jurisdiction over it. It's funny because at this point, it was a licensed property and DC kind of sort of knew what to do with it. But now that they've had full ownership of it for quite some time, you know, they don't really seem to know what to do with the character.
Power of Shazam era, didn't they own it by that point?
Yes, by that point they did. I think somewhere in the late 70s, 80s, somewhere in there, they got ownership of it. I don't know exactly when.
Yeah, and I think that series is pretty good.
But really, since that point, they tried to promote Junior to be Shazam. Never really took hold. With the New 52 stuff, tried to redo Billy and whatnot in Justice League, and that never really got too much traction up until recently where he got his series, and that's petering out. So,
well, you got Mary was a major part of the end of Final Crisis.
And she was also part of, I was trying to think if that was in the 52 era or whatever.
Her and Wonder Woman fighting it out at the end of Final Crisis is actually a great sequence.
Yeah. Well, again, she's a great character, and going from her red costume to her white costume to then at that point you're talking about the black costume.
Yep.
Ton of fun.
Yep. And I believe there's an episode in the archives with you and Kay. The film, I think, did a great job.
Mm-hmm.
I think they did a really good job with the film, too. So I wouldn't say they have no idea what to do. I think it's been spotty and hit and miss with the comics, though.
Well, and that's the thing, is on the comic side, I think they've struggled.
Yeah.
Because the character did well in the 70s, you know, on TV, had a cartoon for a little bit, and it's a character that, at his height, was way more popular than Superman, and there's no particular reason it can't be again. They just need to get the right creator with the right take at the right time.
I'm trying to remember. The New 52 era, it was like the 10-page backups in action, right? Or 8-page or something.
It was Justice League.
Well, okay, but it was a backup. It was a short, just a few pages as a backup in something, right?
It was giving his origin at that point, yeah.
Yeah, and while it's a little darker than what this is, I remember enjoying that. It was 6-8 pages every month or so.
It was an insufficient amount, and that Billy was a bit more of a jerk.
Yeah, yes, but Freddy was so great.
True. I guess what I like about this era is while you've got the sidekicks, essentially, of Mary and Junior, you don't have, like, five of them, which really kind of dilute the uniqueness of Captain Marvel.
Now, I saw that in the film. Is that in the comics now? Because I don't think I've read any of the comics since the New 52 era of backups.
Those kids were essentially introduced in Flashpoint.
Got it.
And then with the New 52, they've been a staple of the Billy Batson storyline. And they're not bad characters.
They're not!
I just don't think they've been really particularly fleshed out, and they're not sufficiently unique.
That's true. I don't feel like I know as much about them as Marvel and Billy. And Freddy, I mean.
Yeah. You got Pedro, you've got a couple of the others, you got a couple of different colors of them now, and
yeah.
It's like, which color is which character and whatnot. And even in the movie, we saw so little of them, it was hard to really kind of get to know them too well.
Yeah, well, we got to know the kids a little bit.
True.
The sequence at the end where, yes, all of a sudden they all have powers, you didn't get to know much of those characters.
Yeah, yeah. So, definitely some fun stuff. I think people that would like this kind of story would really like it, but it's not for everybody, just because it's a different storytelling sensibility. You know, and not everything is for everybody.
Yeah, no, and there's nothing wrong with it. Like I said, I really enjoy it. It's different.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly just fun, good stuff.
Yeah, ton of fun. Really enjoyed it. But I am looking forward to it getting a little bit more Silver Age-ish.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it could really hit kind of that sweet spot for me and really, you know, fire on all cylinders.
Yeah, and like I said, to me, I agree with you. It's golden agey in a way, but see, when I think of the golden age, I just think of really boring, nonsensical stuff, and this isn't that. It's got a sense of humor, it's a little different than pure golden age.
Yes, it's got enough Silver Age sensibility to it,
mm-hmm.
but it's still got some of the wackiness of the, you know, here's a book that basically has magic or whatever. Here's a, you know, there's a rules of physics don't apply in this world at times kind of wackiness to it.
Well, they apply. They just apply in their way.
True. Kinda true.
Like the Looney Tunes.
They're very flexible.
Yes.
Negotiable.
Negotiable. Yes.
So I'm looking forward to finishing out the hardcover and seeing, you know, how this evolves. And I'm thinking around issue 25 or so, we might even get an appearance of the Isis of the time. She had an 8-issue series going around this time, and she was also in the live-action Saturday morning stuff owned by Filmation.
Didn't she start there?
That character started there. The Isis we've had in DC is a different Isis.
Okay, but the Marvel family Isis is the Filmation character, correct?
When you say the Marvel family Isis, do you mean the one from, like, 52 and that series and such?
No, I'm thinking more of the one we would have seen in the late 70s, early 80s occasionally.
That would be the Filmation one, and we'll see her, yes. Like, I think in issue 25 here.
Awesome.
Because she showed up really infrequently because she was not a DC Universe character.
Yeah.
But the Filmation library is one that I really wish DC would kind of buy out. Get that version of Isis, which I think would be awesome, and just get a couple of the other random characters they had of the era, you know, Super Stretch and Micro Woman and some of those characters, and build up kind of Earth-S again, and just have some fun with it. Anything else?
No.
Cool. We'll come back in 2 weeks and do another 100 pages or so.
Sure.
Awesome.
The October 2020 previews came out on September 30th, and the deadline for preview spotlight number 155 is the morning of Saturday, October 10th, 2020. Recording clips for the preview spotlight episodes is easy, and we've got an open submission policy for these episodes. Please send in clips to support the comics you love as often as you can. If you'd like to get email reminders for the Preview Spotlight episodes, you can join the emailing list on the main page of the comicbookpage.com website. The October 2020 previews came out on September 30th, and the deadline for Preview Spotlight number 155 is the morning of Saturday, October 10th, 2020. And a quick reminder that we've also got the recommendation roundtable episodes going. The point of those episodes is to help people find other ways to spend their time. So send in pics of comic books, either older ones, back issues, trades, whatever, novels, television shows, movies, video games, if there's a board game you think people might really enjoy or something. Let's get that out there. We've got a lot of ways we can spend our time in helping people find things that they might be interested in. It's just a great thing to do. I've gotten a lot of clips from Billy Hogan. I want to thank him for that. It reminded me that I should really go reread Astro City and put a few other things kind of back on my radar, including a couple of novels he recommended. I've added those to my reading list. We'll see when I get to them. But we've got no deadline for these episodes. The way these episodes work is you send in one clip per pick, and that could be a particular book or video game or TV show, or it could be a series of books, anything that's kind of a unified thing. And when I get enough of those clips, I'll string them together, I'll kick out an episode. So that means if I get tons of clips, like when Billy sent me about, I don't know, an hour and 45 minutes of some great clips, that was enough for me to get two episodes put together, about an hour for one and about 45 minutes or so for the other. So that's what episodes 2 and 3 are. But if I don't get clips, it may be a while before that next episode comes out. And the reason I'm doing this is there are a lot of things hitting like the streaming services and stuff like that on not really a set cadence like we've got for the Preview Spotlight. So if you wake up one morning and say, you know what, there's a bunch of stuff I think people might enjoy, spend a few minutes, send in the clips, they get in the queue. And if it's another few months before you do the next one, that's great. But hopefully we have enough people sending in clips on a regular enough basis that we can be putting one of these episodes out every month, every other month, or something like that. So once again, the point here is just to recommend older comic books, novels, television shows, movies, video games, or anything else that doesn't really fit the format of the Preview Spotlight, but that you really want to kind of share your love of and encourage other people to check out. So once again, there's no deadline on those recommendation roundtable clips. It's an open invitation for everybody at all times. So please send in clips when you've got something you're thinking about and share the love. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.